Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Zuma is told to repay part of a $23 million home makeover. And police in Kenya say arrested men were planning an attack. I'm Francis Alonso reporting from Washington. South Africa's top anti-corruption official has accused President Jacob Zuma of misconduct for accepting a state-funded $23 million upgrade to his home. The report by public protector Thuli Mandunsela says the president should repay some of the cost for the makeover of his compound. The upgrade, which the government said was done for security reasons, included the installation of a swimming pool, cattle corral, and an amphitheater. Mandunsela says the president never objected to the spending. The report was released today, 6 weeks before South Africa holds national elections. Kenyan police have arrested two men they say had explosives that were to be used in an attack. Police said the men were of Somali origin, and Mombasa police said they suspect the men are linked to the Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab. The vehicle the two were driving was seized near the port city of Mombasa. Police found heavy explosives and automatic weapons concealed inside. Pro-Russian forces have taken control of Ukraine's Navy headquarters in the Crimean port of Sevastopol. It comes a day after Russia signed a treaty with local authorities to make Crimea part of Russia. Witnesses say at least 200 unarmed self-defense forces entered the base today and raised the Russian flag. Ukrainian service members did not resist the takeover and were seen leaving the facility. The majority Russian region voted in a referendum on Sunday to break away from Ukraine and join Russia. Australia's Foreign Affairs Minister Julie Bishop says the referendum was not legitimate.
The actions taken by Russia are a clear violation of international rules prohibiting the use of force and protecting the territorial integrity of states. International law does not allow one state to steal the territory of another on the basis of a referendum that cannot be considered free or fair.
You can read more on that story at voanews.com. Frustration over the lack of progress in the search for a missing Malaysian Airlines jet erupted today at a daily news conference where Chinese relatives of missing passengers confronted Malaysian officials. The grieving families burst into the room where the media briefing was to be held, yelling and holding a banner defending Malaysia. Tell the truth. And what happened to the plane that has been missing since March 8th? Two-thirds of the plane's 227 passengers were Chinese. Many of their families have become increasingly angry about what they feel is contradictory or confusing information released by Malaysia. U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama arrives in China Thursday for a six-day visit along with her daughters and mother. Bill Hyde has details.
Even before Ms. Obama arrived in Beijing, Chinese state media reports were emphasizing the visit, calling it a sequel to last year's informal get-together in Sunnylands, California, between President Barack Obama and China's Xi Jinping. The first day of her trip will be spent with her Chinese counterpart in Beijing, Mr. Xi's wife and First Lady Peng Liyuan. The two will visit a school and the Forbidden City. They will also attend a performance after dinner. The capital's popular Beijing News talked about how First Lady diplomacy could play a unique role in U.S.-China relations. Bill Hyde, Beijing.
The world's biggest automaker, Japan's Toyota Motor Corporation, is admitting that it intentionally misled the public about deadly car safety problems several years ago and has agreed to pay a $1.2 billion fine to the United States to settle a criminal investigation. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder announced the resolution of the four-year case in Washington today, calling the company's conduct shameful. Holder said Toyota attempted to protect its corporate image at the expense of the world's car buyers. He said the company engaged in a clear and reprehensible abuse of public trust. The Obama administration is launching a new online effort to warn the public about the dangers of climate change. The White House is unveiling a new website today, climate.data.gov. It lets citizens, businesses, and local governments take the latest scientific data and see how their communities will be affected by rising seas, heat waves, and drought. More details at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonso, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders warns that drug-resistant tuberculosis has become a global threat. It says despite the growing number of cases, there are no effective treatments.
That's VOA's Joe DiCapua reporting. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, unrest in Egypt has resulted in at least seven deaths as security forces raided a militant hideout near Cairo. Members of a recently suspended political party in Burundi could receive life sentences for a political protest that turned violent earlier this month. And Italian naval authorities have rescued more than 2,000 immigrants off the south coast of Sicily. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, unrest in Egypt has resulted in at least seven deaths as security forces raided a militant hideout near Cairo and police fired tear gas at Islamist demonstrators in the capital. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Egypt's interior ministry says two officers were killed along with five militants when Egyptian police, military, and special forces clashed with Islamist militants during a raid on a reported safe house of the Sinai-based group Ansar Beit al-Maqdis just north of Cairo. The militants opened fire on security forces and set off the car bombs, sparking a gun battle that lasted several hours, the ministry said. The group has stepped up attacks on Egyptian security forces since the military ousted Islamist President Mohamed Morsi last year. Last week, militants ambushed a military police checkpoint in Kalyupia, killing a number of young policemen. Also Wednesday, an Egyptian court sentenced more than two dozen Islamists, many in absentia, to death over violent attacks in the port city of Suez. One man was also given a 15-year sentence. Elsewhere in the Egyptian capital, police fired volleys of tear gas at clusters of young men around Cairo University after a protest by Muslim Brotherhood students spilled into the main boulevard facing the campus. The protesters pelted police with stones and bottles in streets near the university. Police prevented protesters at Al-Azhar University on the opposite side of Cairo from going off campus, although young men threw stones at passing vehicles and police. Egyptian media also reported scattered clashes in Nasrout and several other towns across the country. The Muslim Brotherhood website accused police of assaulting students at Al-Azhar University and claimed the protests marked a new revolution. But the protests were fairly small compared to many in the 3 years since a popular uprising toppled longtime President Hosni Mubarak in February 2011. Former Egyptian senator and American University of Cairo political science professor Mona Makram Obeid tells VOA she thinks the Muslim Brotherhood is hoping to prolong the uncertainty and instability in Egypt by calling for more protests.
These protests have been going on for quite a long time now, disturbing the students who want to continue to study and who have exams coming up. But, of course, this is all instigated by the Muslim Brothers who want to continue this state of, you know, of turmoil, of violence, of uncertainty, particularly with the approach of the new presidential elections.
The Wednesday protests came as many Egyptians expected an announcement by Defense Minister Abdel Fattah al-Sisi that he would resign his post to run for president. Egypt's Masr al-Yom newspaper said the announcement would take place on Wednesday or by Thursday at the latest. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Italian naval authorities have rescued more than 2,000 immigrants off the south coast of Sicily in the last 2 days. The high number includes nearly 600 picked up on the Mediterranean on Monday. Three merchant ships aided Italy's task force in the latest rescue operation. Italy has for decades rescued thousands of African refugees in overcrowded and unsafe boats sailing to the Italian island of Lampedusa. Those numbers have escalated since the 2011 Arab Spring revolutions in North Africa. Hundreds have drowned in the Mediterranean in failed attempts to reach Europe. The European Union Border Agency says more than 20,000 have entered Europe illegally through Lampedusa and other Sicilian ports in the last 4 months of 2013. More attempts by sea are expected as better sailing weather nears. The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders warns that drug-resistant tuberculosis has become a global threat. It says despite the growing number of cases, there are no effective treatments. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Doctors Without Borders has released a crisis alert called the new face of an old disease. The group, also known by the French acronym MSF, says urgent action is needed to solve the problem. Dr. Philippe Ducrot is a TB advisor for MSF.
In MSF's experience, we're seeing MDR-TB, or multidrug-resistant TB, in more and more countries and in more numbers in our programs.
There are about 500,000 new cases of MDR-TB every year. Ducrot says it's hard enough dealing with MDR-TB, let alone an even stronger strain of the bacteria that causes XDR-TB, or extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis. He tells the story of an infected child in Central Asia.
After a year of treatment, she was failing treatment with all the drugs that we have. So this poor child had gone through treatment where she had suffered from nausea almost every day, and she was going deaf from one of the drugs. She was having to take over 7 different drugs every day, all with different side effects. And despite trying to take all of this treatment, she was failing treatment and showing the limits of the treatment that we have available currently.
Standard TB drugs do not work against the new forms of the disease. Treatment for MDR-TB could last 2 years, during which time a patient may swallow 10,000 pills and have daily injections for 8 months. And after all that, it may not work.
I think the main reason this has got to be a big problem is that although we've made some progress tackling TB, in recent years the global community has turned away from investing in improving on what we can do with TB. We've been satisfied with old answers. The reality is that we don't have currently the answers that will solve the problem of TB. We don't have actually effective treatments in new regimens that will actually tackle the large epidemic of multidrug-resistant TB.
Ducrot says bacteria can build resistance when TB patients fail to complete their drug regimen and when countries do not strictly control the use of medications.
It's a global problem which the global community needs to take responsibility for. Not just international organizations like our own or the World Health Organization, but I think also governments and pharmaceutical companies and academics. There are maybe lots of good individual initiatives, but I think as a global community, we really need to come together urgently and look at how we can have faster solutions that are going to deliver a real change at ground level for this epidemic.
The solution, he says, is a much shorter, more effective treatment. Currently, there are only about 5 to 8 drugs used to treat resistant TB, depending on the regimen needed. The 2 latest drugs available are actually the first new TB medications developed in 40 years.
Although that's cause for optimism, we still don't know how to use those drugs in new regimens, and so we're limited by adding them to a regimen that is already highly toxic and difficult for patients to take.
Dr. Ducrot says if a global investment is not made to address the epidemic, there will be a price to pay.
As an example, in the United States in the early 90s, there was an outbreak of multidrug-resistant TB. And as a result of a few hundred cases, the public health program invested nearly $1 billion US. That number of patients is not even a third of what we see in one of our programs in one country. If we don't start to step in early to deal with the problem now, you can multiply that figure by a huge number that you can pluck out of the air.
Doctors Without Borders says with only 1 in 5 people in need receiving treatment, the fatal airborne disease is left to spread indiscriminately. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up on 16 Minutes Past the Hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Human Rights Watch says the government of Senegal needs to do more to crack down on so-called Quranic schools that abuse young boys and force them to beg on the streets for food and spare change. The forced begging has been a problem for years in Senegal, and the government had pledged to eliminate it by 2015. But HRW says little progress has been made. Jennifer Lazuta has more from Dakar.
You don't have to go far on the streets of Dakar before being approached by barefoot young boys in tattered t-shirts asking for money or food. The boys, known as Talibé, can be as young as 4 years old. They ask for 100 seifa, or about 20 cents. They hold out empty tomato cans to collect coins and food. They need to meet their daily quota or face serious consequences. Matt Wells, a West Africa researcher for Human Rights Watch, explains.
Each day, tens of thousands of boys across the country are sent out onto the streets to beg. They generally have to bring back a set amount of money, uncooked rice and sugar, that's handed over to the Quranic teacher. And when they fail to bring back that amount of money, they're often beaten quite brutally.
Wells has studied the Taliban in Senegal since 2010 and has written several reports on the topic. He says the boys often live in overcrowded, unsanitary rooms. They go hungry and receive very little actual education, religious or otherwise. Not all Quranic schools in Senegal, known as daras, engage in such exploitation and abuse. However, a government survey this year found that of the nearly 55,000 children enrolled in Quranic schools in Dakar, more than 30,000 currently practice begging. The problem is not new in Senegal, but activists say authorities have been slow to do anything about it. Laws that forbid forced begging are rarely enforced. However, on the streets of Dakar, public opinion is slowly changing.
Franchement, c'est pas une bonne initiative là. Il faut d'abord trouver une solution pour les enfants.
36-year-old Abdoulaye Badji says we need to find a solution for these children, because to leave them out in the streets like that, it's truly not good. These boys, they have no future, he says. They need better housing, for example, but the government is busy with other things. At the very least, they could recruit better teachers. There have been several high-profile cases of abuse in recent years. In March 2013, 8 Talibé died in a fire in Dakar. Their teacher had locked them in the school building where they were living. Neighbors said they knew the man was locking the children inside the school. In the aftermath of the deadly fire, the government once again pledged to crack down on child begging and to better regulate Quranic schools. But it's been 1 year, and HRW says the state has only shut down one Quranic school for safety reasons. HRW says there are hundreds more that can be easily identified as violating the rights of their students. Senegal's Ministry of Justice says it is aware of the Taliban problem and is working on new legislation. Awa Ndour, a representative for the Ministry of Justice's Task Force Against Human Trafficking, says the fight against child begging is a process that involves many different actors, not just the government. We are working to pass a new law to regulate Quranic schools and also to ensure the 2005 law is applied, she says. But there is a lot of cultural resistance to such laws in Senegal. There is often lobbying by religious groups, so authorities must fight this resistance to fight child begging. HRW's Wells says a law dealing specifically with the regulation of Quranic schools would be a step in the right direction. But, he adds, the government would then have to enforce the new regulations. Jennifer Lazuta for VOA News, Dakar.
Members of a recently suspended political party in Burundi could receive life sentences for a political protest that turned violent earlier this month. The case highlights growing political tensions in the country ahead of next year's presidential election. VOA's East Africa correspondent Gabe Joslow reports.
On March 8th, demonstrators from the opposition Movement for Solidarity and Democracy, MSD, took to the streets of Burundi's capital, Bujumbura, to protest against what they saw as the government's restrictions on political freedoms. They were met by riot police, who fired tear gas to break up the protest. More than a dozen opposition members were injured during clashes that followed, while two policemen were briefly held hostage at MSD headquarters. Now, the party has been suspended for 4 months, and 46 party members are on trial, facing the possibility of life in prison on charges of insurrection, violence against police, and rebellion. Another 22 are facing lesser charges. The president of the Forum for Strengthening Civil Society in Burundi, Vital Nshimirimana, says the March 8th crackdown was politically guided.
The police shows that it is not neutral. It is not neutral in the sense that it is a kind of led by some thought of the ruling party.
Presidential advisor Gervais Abayehu denies there is any deliberate crackdown on the opposition. He tells VOA the protesters violated an order by the Interior Minister that banned political rallies on that particular day, which coincided with a public celebration of International Women's Day.
Things in this country are such that if you do not go by the law, if you do not respect what the Interior Minister is saying or the government is saying, it does not matter whether you are in opposition or whether you are in the ruling party, you have to face the full force of the law.
The recent violence has grabbed the attention of the international community. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon issued a statement after the clashes urging both sides to show restraint while deploring the growing restrictions on the freedom of expression, association, and assembly in Burundi. The U.S. State Department condemned the government's use of heavy-handed tactics to break up the rally. Abayehu says the overall political atmosphere is not as bad as it is made out to be, noting that the government has set up forums to discuss issues of concern among political parties. He says the international community should not rely on information it gets from the opposition.
If the international community relies on what is really the reality in the country, I think there is no reason, there is no cause for concern in this country. We see the country being stable, being peaceful.
Some activists believe the government is intentionally stifling the opposition in order to place the ruling party in a stronger position ahead of next year's presidential and parliamentary elections. The opposition boycotted the last vote in 2010 because of concerns of vote rigging, giving an easy victory to President Pierre Nkurunziza. Jean-Claude Nkundwa, a Burundian peace activist living in the United States, has concerns about the next vote given the current political conditions.
There is a need of support of this election process that is coming to ensure that it's fair and transparent. And it will not be fair and transparent if the democratic principles are not respected.
Nkundwa is a survivor of the ethnic conflict that took place in Burundi more than 20 years ago, along the same Hutu-Tutsi lines as the genocide in neighboring Rwanda. Since then, political reforms helped promote reconciliation in the country. But now, Nkundwa says he fears Burundi is sliding backwards.
It's getting dangerous because the frustration always has been the cause of war. People feel their needs of justice are not met, and people try to express themselves and they crack down, and then at the end there is explosion.
Civil society groups are also concerned about constitutional changes proposed by the ruling party that would reduce the powers of the vice president, among other changes to the existing balance of power. Activists have accused the ruling party of trying to change the laws to allow a third term for President Nkurunziza. The government strongly denies the allegation and says the proposed changes will put the country more in line with the political systems of its East African neighbors. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
The World Food Program says it will fall far short of its goal of feeding 4 million people in the DRC this year because of a severe funding shortage. It also warns it will have to drastically cut its current programs unless international donors respond to its appeal. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The World Food Program has been low on cash for some time. Last year, it cut food rations across the board for all its beneficiaries in the Democratic Republic of Congo. It also scaled back some other activities in hopes of salvaging most of its humanitarian operation. But this has not worked. WFP says it expects to run out of food next month in most of the country. Spokeswoman Elizabeth Beers tells VOA her agency will be forced to discontinue food aid except in the areas of greatest suffering.
This is an heartbreaking decision, but without funding, we cannot buy the food. We cannot buy the 3,000 tons of specialized nutritional product for babies. We need 15,000 metric tons of food in the next 6 months to provide assistance in form of our cash and voucher program. So we will have to scale down all those programs, long-term program, in-depth program, because of the lack of funding.
The WFP appealed for $478 million to pay for humanitarian assistance in the DRC between July 2013 and December 2015. To date, it has received only 26% of this request. The agency says it urgently needs $48 million to carry through its operations until August. Currently, WFP is feeding 1.5 million people every month in DRC. It says it plans to increase that number to 2.2 million people this year, but that is nowhere near the 4.2 million people it had hoped to reach. Because it is cash poor, Beer says WFP will now focus its aid operations on the most vulnerable people.
Those who suffer the most and the most are in need of life-saving assistance. And we will cut and ration, and we will also scale down our school meal program and focus only on those, on the children, for instance, who need the most urgent assistance, the most life-saving assistance.
The narrowed feeding programs will target those who are internally displaced by conflict in Congo's eastern provinces, including Katanga, Oriental, and North and South Kivu, and the thousands of refugees from Central African Republic. Most of the 63,000 refugees are in northwestern Equateur province. Half of them are living in camps and are supported by WFP. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Solly coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Skip Sisk, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Dante, AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at UpfrontAfrica.